You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The United States accounts for half of the world's $60 billion retail trade in diamonds. In recent years, some of the diamonds sold here have been smuggled out of Africa. The diamonds are known as conflict or blood diamonds. On the program today, we talk with a journalist who has investigated the death and destruction diamond smuggling has caused in West Africa and elsewhere. Our guest is Greg Campbell, author of Blood Diamonds, Tracing the Deadly Path of the World's Most Precious Stones. The book tells the story of how diamond smuggling works and how conflict diamonds have crippled Sierra Leone. It looks at how these stones have helped bankroll terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, and it explains how the diamond industry has contributed to the horrors of conflict diamonds. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little more about our guest, Greg Campbell. He's an award-winning freelance journalist. His work has appeared in the Christian Science Monitor and the San Francisco Chronicle. He is also the author of the book, The Road to Kosovo, A Balkan Diary. His new book, Blood Diamonds, is published by Westview Press. Again, the telephone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Greg Campbell, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to begin where you begin in this book, in a camp for amputees.
Mm-hmm.
Would you please introduce us to Ismail Dalrami?
I certainly will. And Ismail Dalrami, the person whose story I'll briefly illustrate, is unfortunately not an uncommon character in and around Sierra Leone. He was a farmer who lived in the small West African country of Sierra Leone, still lives in the capital of Freetown, but he spent most of his life in the upcountry tropical jungles in one of the towns where diamond mining is one of the most prevalent industries. It's one of the most prevalent activities that takes place. Common civilian, just like you or I, just struggling to survive from day to day. He had a small taxi business in addition to his subsistence farming. And in 1996, at the height of a civil war between the Sierra Leone government and the rebels of the Revolutionary United Front, the town that he lived in fell to the rebel forces, and he was quickly captured by rebel soldiers. And instead of being placed into forced labor or made a prisoner of war or executed for complicity with the government, he had his hands amputated with an axe, and he and several other civilians who were captured were forced into a line at gunpoint by teenage soldiers of the RUF, and forced to place their arms on a wooden stump. And another rebel wielding an axe amputated both of his arms and then those of everyone else in line. And this signature war crime tactic of the RUF is something that actually has a military strategy, because many of the people in line, Dalrami reported to me, had begged to be killed rather than going through with this torturous amputation. But the rebels weren't interested in killing them. They wanted to amputate them so that they could set them on the road to other villages where they could spread the message that this was the type of treatment that civilians caught by the Revolutionary United Front could expect. And the strategy had its desired effect. Populations shifted titanically across Sierra Leone once word of the rebels' atrocities became pretty well known. And people were moving in droves away from the one goal of this war, which was control of Sierra Leone's very valuable diamond mines.
Mm.
And estimates are hard to come by because populations are so fluid in that area of Africa. But the best estimates that I've come up with are that some 20,000 people had been amputated in such a way, either both arms or one arm or other various body parts were amputated just with, in the crudest of ways, with a machete or with homemade axes and sent to kind of wander around the area as kind of walking memorials to the depravity of this rebel group.
Yeah, and this rebel group, its reason for being was not really political. It was its motivation was greed. It was to get control of the diamond mines.
That's correct. It was very much an organized crime rebellion rather than a rebellion that was rooted in an ideology or a desire to replace one presumably corrupt government with a better one. The rebels had no interest necessarily in winning over the hearts and minds of the rural population, of the peasants. Didn't seek to make its ranks larger with the intellectuals and the student society. It was purely a guerrilla movement that had very little interest in anything except control of Sierra Leone's vast wealth. And there's something like, I think the best estimates of how much wealth there actually is, it can be traced back to the 1960s when one of the most reliable studies of Sierra Leone's geological surplus was done. And the yield that was anticipated at a height of diamond production was something like 2 million carats of diamonds a year could be pulled from this country that's the size of South Carolina. And so when the rebels first began their campaign in 1991, there was kind of, you know, it was a bit of lip service paid to kind of a Maoist rhetoric of, you know, rise up now, the population of the bush, the impoverished citizens of Sierra Leone will no longer be exploited by the ruling class in Freetown, the capital, and here we are to come and give you better health services, better education, and so forth, to join the ranks of the RUF and help the cause. But that quickly was washed away by the horrors of the realities of the war, which involved many of these amputation campaigns, in addition to, you know, a number of other very serious war crimes and breaches of the Geneva Convention, mass rapes, extrajudicial executions, random torturings, induction of child soldiers into its ranks, and so forth.
Yeah. At one point in the story, you say diamonds and drugs can sometimes have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. And it was very illuminating to talk to one of my colleagues who worked in West Africa, Douglas Farah, who is a reporter for The Washington Post. He had also spent a great deal of his career in Colombia with, you know, researching and reporting on the drug cartels and their ruthless tactics of control of the land and the natural resources in that country. And their bloody tactics were, in many cases, not as bad as the rebels of Sierra Leone, in his estimation.
Yeah, and that is something that we've heard a lot more about in this hemisphere. And so to put it that way, I think says a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's about correct. And amazingly, you know, we hear very, you know, like you said, a lot about the war on drugs, a lot about eradication efforts in South America and the countries that are involved. And we hear very little, if anything, about the results of this other war, which in many ways are much, much more terrible. And the driving force there is not an illegal narcotic, but it's one of the most prized luxury items that that is known to man.
Mm. You know, the diamond industry has been known for keeping very tight control of diamonds.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
So when, you know, what I want to ask you here is, when and how did the trade in illicit diamonds begin? How was it that the diamond industry lost control of mines?
Well, it's a great question, and it goes more or less to the heart of why we have this problem in the first place, because the diamond industry was so intent on control of this commodity, this luxury item, these diamonds that were being harvested throughout the world, that a system was adopted and was put in place by the diamond industry itself that allowed all of this to occur in the first place. And if I can skip back about 100 years just to quickly lay the groundwork, when diamonds were first discovered in South Africa in the 1880s, it was very similar to the California Gold Rush. Thousands and thousands of vagabond diggers came from across the globe to hunt for their fortunes in South Africa, and in many cases they were finding them. There were diamonds being pulled out left and right from literally sometimes found in the street. And diamonds up until that point had been considered extremely rare, very, very precious, and commanded an excellent price around the world from people who from kings and queens to everyday people who wanted to buy one or who could afford one for a marriage or for an anniversary. And one of the people who was busily digging in the dirt in South Africa, who came to found the largest and most influential diamond company in the history of the world, De Beers, a man named Cecil Rhodes, took a look at the situation and very astutely decided that with all the good diamonds that were coming out of the ground, there was no way that the prices that were being commanded on the market would be maintained if all of these diamonds were allowed to go to market, simply a supply and demand type of equation. So over the course of the next couple of decades, Rhodes embarked on a campaign to buy up as many diamond claims as he could in South Africa and control all the diamonds. And he explained it that way as he was buying the claims, offering everybody shares in his new company, De Beers. And when he was completed with his consolidation efforts in the late 1880s, De Beers was founded and controlled 90% of all the rough diamonds that were found throughout the world. So in order to maintain that type of control, De Beers and its subsidiary companies and its affiliated corporations and its partners that were unaffiliated, they needed to basically pursue the diamonds anywhere that they were being discovered, because throughout the last century, diamonds started showing up in Angola, in Namibia, in Botswana, and in Sierra Leone. So what that meant in terms of keeping their strategy alive was that they had to buy these diamonds wherever they were found in order to avoid a glut of good diamonds on the market. And this policy has resulted in a giant stockpile of diamonds from across the globe being kept in a vault, literally, in London. And every 5 weeks, the De Beers Corporation will very carefully parse out a certain amount of diamonds to its hand-selected buyers who come from New York and Antwerp and Bombay and everywhere to get the best stones in the world. And they receive their packages, and then they go off and have these diamonds cut and polished and turned into jewelry. And once they're out on the market, since there is a finite amount of diamonds on the market, the prices are artificially maintained. It's just a pure monopoly structure, and it works very well in terms of a monopoly structure. But what that realistically meant was that De Beers had to buy the stones from literally whomever was selling them. And that also included rebel groups in Angola and in Sierra Leone. So when the RUF invaded and they took over a diamond mine and they used forced labor to extract the diamonds from the ground, they knew that they had a very willing market to sell into. And in fact, it was no problem moving the diamonds from the battlefield into the retail stores, simply because diamonds were so valuable because of this artificial structure that De Beers had implemented, that buyers from across the globe wound up in Monrovia, the capital of neighboring Liberia, and would just simply camp out at designated hotels or bars or, you know, your prototypical seedy tropical environment for diamond smuggling. And then RUF rebels and couriers would come back across the border from Sierra Leone and simply sell them for cash to diamond merchants, you know, from very respected organizations in Europe. And those people would then take the diamonds back with them and have them cut, polished, and resold for an abundant value compared to what they purchased them for.
And then ultimately they wind up on fingers and in ears and mm-hmm. around necks.
Yes, inevitably.
Of course, they also find their way into the hands of terrorist groups.
One of the incredible things about this story, as I was doing the research, was how well known this trade has been throughout not only the diamond industry but throughout all the countries in West Africa that I visited. Everybody was very, very open about, yes, of course, illegal diamonds are trading hands in Sierra Leone or making their way across the borders to the Gambia, to Guinea, to Conakry, to Liberia, and then, you know, being exported out elsewhere. And there were simply no controls on diamond exports or imports from West Africa. When a diamond is imported, for instance, to Belgium from Conakry, it is duly recorded on customs documents as having come from Conakry, and in other words, its origin is a Guinean diamond. And throughout the 1990s when the rebels were controlling the diamonds in Sierra Leone and official exports from Sierra Leone practically stopped, the neighboring countries saw an explosion in the volume of diamonds that were being exported from those countries to the point where it was obvious, even at a cursory glance, that they were conflict diamonds, simply because geologists have a way of estimating how much a country could potentially produce. And in many cases, for instance, Liberia was exporting some six times the number of diamonds that it could physically produce, and no one was asking any of the questions in Europe. And the main reason that no one was asking the questions is because it was economically viable not to. And what I mean by that is that no one on the consumer end of the product had thought twice about exactly where their diamonds are coming from, in many cases don't care, and that was just fine with the diamond industry and the people who were marketing the diamonds and selling them and who were engaged in this trade. And so therefore they didn't, it was kind of a don't ask, don't tell type of policy. And the nefarious organizations of the world, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, had seen this loophole and had seen the world's disdain, I guess is probably a good word, for actively investigating the source and origin of some diamonds or exactly who they were coming from, and used it to exploit for their own measures. For instance, in 1998, Al-Qaeda began buying diamonds from the RUF on a massive scale, and they were simply laundering their money. They were turning their cash into diamonds, and as we've seen, diamonds can easily move across borders. They can be resold at a very high value. So they're a very highly liquid, highly mobile asset to have, very valuable thing. And Al-Qaeda very well may have been anticipating September 11th when it began this buying spree, because it was in effect all the way up until perhaps a month before the attacks on the World Trade Center and Washington, D.C. And it had been going on for approximately 3 years. And all this information was uncovered by my friend Doug Farah at the Washington Post, and he quoted a source in his story that said, in order to shut off Al-Qaeda funding, it's very likely that we'll have to shut down the diamond pipeline from these illicit organizations.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Greg Campbell. He's the author of Blood Diamonds, Tracing the Deadly Path of the World's Most Precious Stones. He has investigated the death and destruction diamond smuggling has caused in West Africa and elsewhere, perhaps here in the United States. Greg Campbell, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. The telephone numbers, if you'd like to join us in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Doug Farah, quite a reporter. Tell us about the story that he broke that landed on the paper's front page November 1st, 2001.
That was the big eye-opener for many people across the world about exactly what the role the diamonds have played, not just in the West African countries that I visited, but in terms of global terrorism as well. Doug was in Sierra Leone trying to connect the dots between Middle Eastern fundraisers and West African wars. There are very many Lebanese who live in West Africa. They moved there in droves in the wake of World War II to sell general merchandise, electronics, equipment, machinery, and so forth. And when diamonds were discovered in Sierra Leone in the 1930s, they were very well poised to help the people who were in the bush digging them out of the ground. They were natural partners because the people who were digging the diamonds didn't necessarily have access to export licenses or equipment. So a system developed whereby Lebanese import-export businessmen would supply the diggers with their shovels, with their gasoline-powered water pumps, with pay for a supply of diggers and food and so forth, in exchange for the diamonds minus the overhead. So it was a symbiosis that was worked out pretty well. It worked out, you know, for many decades in Sierra Leone, and in fact is a system that stays in place today. If you go visit some of these upcountry bush villages, many places don't have operating electricity, or any of the modern amenities that we're used to. But there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of storefronts owned by Lebanese. And the storefronts are emblazoned with gigantic signs that say diamond merchant and hand-painted pictures of lustrous diamonds. And it's quite jarring to see the conditions of the jungle and the conditions that the people are living in, which are very impoverished, juxtaposed with this image of lustrous luxury and wealth. But indeed, many of the diamonds are pulled out of the ground in neighboring districts and brought to many of these little diamond centers. There are a handful. And then sold to the Lebanese and exported legally and legitimately from Sierra Leone to other places. Well, the belief is that there are some Shiite Muslim extremists among these Lebanese, and that they have used the proceeds from their business to help fund Hezbollah and their attacks against Israel and American interests throughout the course of the past 20 years or so. And my friend Doug was investigating those connections in Sierra Leone when he accidentally stumbled upon, what to me would have certainly been the greatest story of my life if I had been in his position. He discovered instead that Al-Qaeda had been in Sierra Leone as early as 1998 and had actively been purchasing diamonds, and very openly, in fact. And the thing that's critical about this, just to put it into a context of a time and place, is that very shortly after Al-Qaeda began this scheme in 1998, the United Nations deployed one of the largest peacekeeping missions ever. 17,500 soldiers and something like $680 million a year spent on this mission for this very small country. And Al-Qaeda, in many circumstances, was digging and buying stones directly under the noses of the UN and then smuggling them out either through Liberia or further afield. And Farah more or less confronted the IRF with his information and asked if it was all true. And just through good old-fashioned gumshoe footwork, managed to piece together the story, got it confirmed on the RUF level, and then from the international intelligence level. U.S. and European intelligence investigators confirmed portions of his story as well. And then it hit the streets, as you said, November 1st, 2001. And at that point, the diamond industry had already been backing off a little bit of its prior roles of purchasing diamonds on the open market, regardless of who was selling them. In 1999, a report had come out that was very accusatory. Global Witness was the NGO that sort of exposed this entire nefarious practice of rebel groups selling diamonds into the mainstream. And in the wake of that, it got a lot of attention, and it got the attention of other very influential NGOs such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And those groups began campaigns to educate consumers about where their diamonds were coming from that were having a lot of effect. People suddenly began to question where diamonds came from, either geologically or physically, where the origin of their diamond is. It's something that many people probably have never given a thought to. So in the wake of that, the Global Witness report, the diamond industry took steps to distance itself from these practices. And again, this was less of a moralistic step than it was, yet again, an economic reality that they were facing, that they had to respond to. Because once the NGOs got a hold of the issue, people started talking the dreaded word boycott. And the last thing anybody in the diamond industry wanted to see was a situation that the fur industry suffered from in the 1980s, which was a boycott of its products, a luxury product that was now being tied very clearly and very convincingly to atrocious wars in West Africa. So the industry moved very swiftly to appear that it was doing something, and De Beers again led the way and abolished its policy of buying diamonds on the open market, which meant that the De Beers company has basically ended its philosophy and its strategy of being the market custodian of diamonds and their prices. So De Beers now only sells diamonds from its mines that it controls, or that it controls in partnerships with some governments. So that was one kind of swift blow that took the diamonds out of took some conflict diamonds out of circulation, actually quite a bit. It was something like $15 million worth of conflict goods was wiped out of the market instantaneously once De Beers had made that move.
Hmm. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us, a caller in Urbana on line one. Let's talk with this listener. Good afternoon.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the substance whose name I can't remember now. Maybe you've been looking into it, too. It's used in, it's a rare earth metal or something. And
is it tanzanite?
I guess it figures a lot in the what's kind of the rape of the Congo going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just using that language makes me think that, you know, one can focus on one commodity or another, but I think there's a case to be made, and I don't know if you'll agree or not, that the whole way that Africa has been exploited through the decades is this is sort of an aberration in a way, because it's so so connected directly to the armies and the repression and the mm-hmm. ghastly things. But it isn't that much of a stretch to look back to the Leopold's Congo and see it all in a sort of the same sort of context. So I'm going to get back to my handiwork and listen to you on off the air. Thanks.
Well, your caller is absolutely right. In fact, Cecil Rhodes, the man who founded De Beers in the 1880s, had often said that his goal was to conquer South Africa financially and the control of its natural resources for the sake of the crown. And a lot of African history can, in my opinion, be drawn back to this imperialist, colonialist type of thinking. And in fact, Rhodes then went on behalf of his gold exploration company to conquer another region of Africa that he named after himself, turned it into the country of Rhodesia, and used mercenaries for that effort. And Rhodesia is now Zimbabwe and I think a portion of Zambia. But that is also the case in Sierra Leone, because Sierra Leone was a British colony. And once De Beers had its structure up and running and its mode of operation in terms of swooping in and securing some sort of monopolistic rights to the natural resources of an area where diamonds were found, that's exactly what happened originally in Sierra Leone. The crown administrators there granted a De Beers subsidiary exclusive rights to all the diamonds in Sierra Leone. So what we had then is, you know, a foreign country being completely exploited by a foreign company, of which it was a colony of the crown for the most part. So, in general, I definitely agree with your caller.
Hmm. As a result of the revelations about the connection between terrorism and diamonds mined in Africa, is the U.S. paying more attention to Africa? Is it rethinking its foreign policy in Africa?
That's an excellent question, and I would say that it's probably a little too early to tell in terms of its preventative foreign policy. I would say that absolutely the United States is paying more attention to Africa in a military sense. Africa is practically overrun with spies, with CIA and FBI operatives, and in fact, I'm going to kick myself for not remembering the exact location, but I recently read very briefly a few weeks ago that the U.S. Marines were deployed in an area of West Africa that escapes me at the moment. I apologize. So I would say that definitely the United States is paying better attention to Africa in terms of hunting its enemies and rooting out the enclaves of al-Qaeda resistance that may be there and are very likely still there. I think it remains to be seen about whether or not the United States would do anything different or anything substantially different in terms of intervention in African wars. And this has been a criticism for a long time, and certainly not just this story, but the Rwanda tragedy certainly comes to mind. While Bosnia was playing out and the war in the Balkans was dominating the news for several years in a row, millions of people were being killed in Rwanda with hardly a glance from the Western nations. And in many ways, it's that kind of disregard for what's going on in Africa that allowed al-Qaeda to exploit Sierra Leone so openly, because frankly, the war in Sierra Leone was a bloody, tragic mess that was very, very difficult to understand from afar. And unless you were a member of the diamond industry and were able to put it into a context of this revolution is simply a matter of simply an economic activity, it's something that's supporting a market, that there is a group of people out there who are profiting from this, the rebels directly, and the people who are purchasing the stones from them, practically as directly. I think that it would have been very difficult to muster up very much support for any type of an intervention in Sierra Leone. The British intervened simply because it was a British colony up until 1961, and the British were very supportive of the United Nations effort, which unfortunately was just a very backwards, bumbling, and ill-thought-out mission from its very conception. And the British went in to stabilize the UN mission behind the scenes and are still very actively involved. But it's not anything that I think the British relished doing. I don't think that they wanted to put their boys in harm's way, to coin a phrase, for this country that they couldn't necessarily adequately explain what the cause of the conflict was and what the consequences were of perhaps ignoring the conflict. And unfortunately, we've seen in very clear and very concrete terms what the consequences are of ignoring such seemingly small and insignificant conflicts around the globe. And al-Qaeda, unfortunately, was very smart and was able to see that there was a disdain by the United States and other Western and developed countries to get involved and to put an end to the diamonds for guns conflict, and use that for their purposes, and unfortunately used it very well.
Mm. Do we know that, in fact, Sierra Leone diamonds, conflict diamonds, were used to finance the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001?
No, we don't know for sure. That's unfortunately another one of the aspects of this scheme that is almost perfect in terms of, if you're putting together a plot, a terrorist plot, this is a very good component. Once the diamonds are traded in Sierra Leone or in Monrovia for cash, and the RUF has its cash and al-Qaeda has its diamonds, there's virtually no way to trace the diamonds. So once diamonds are sold in various backwaters or various diamond centers or just about anywhere, you cannot tell where a diamond has come from just by looking at it. There are certain experts in the world who would be able to get pretty close, a pretty good guess, if they were given enough of a sample to peruse, because diamonds retain certain geological properties once they're mined that are uniform from mine to mine. So if you have enough of a sample, an expert may be able to tell with some sort of rough certainty where in the world a certain diamond originated. But to tell individually which mine is almost impossible. And once you dilute the package or dilute the sample, then those diamonds become practically untraceable. So there's no telling at this point, once the diamonds are now mined and in circulation, and no matter where at what point in the circulation, and whether there are still rough stones being traded or if they're cut and polished in jewelry, doesn't make any difference. You can't tell. They're completely invisible, and so they're very liquid. It's difficult to say whether the diamonds themselves were used to finance the attacks. It would be my guess, if I were asked to guess, that instead the diamonds are being used perhaps to fund further actions after, in the wake of September 11th. Because your listeners will recall that one of the first steps that the United States and its allies took after September 11th was to freeze al-Qaeda's financial assets across the globe. And within 3 weeks, some $100 million worth of money was frozen in bank accounts across the land. So it's probably more likely, in my thinking, that the diamonds that were taken from Sierra Leone by al-Qaeda are probably being used as a very liquid asset to sell as needed, and then that money would be used.
Let's take another call. Caller on line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I'm interested in what you may know about the Argyle diamonds that are mined in Western Australia. I was wondering if you have any idea if this sort of illicit trade and damage to people has happened in that area as well. And I have two other parts to that question. I'd also like to know if De Beers controls that area as far as marketing and so forth. And then following everything you've talked about, is there any way that a consumer might find out or have a way of purchasing a diamond knowing that it did not come through the system?
Well, good questions all around. Unfortunately, I know very little about Australia and its diamond mining environment or the structures that are set up there, so I can't answer the questions about Australia. I can tell you that De Beers, anybody who mines diamonds has benefited from De Beers' marketing strategy. I'm sure you've heard the phrase that a diamond is forever. That is a De Beers slogan that everybody who sells diamonds benefits from that slogan. So I guess in an indirect way, De Beers is involved in marketing all diamonds in the world, so by extension, those in Australia. In terms of what consumers can do to educate themselves about where their diamonds come from, currently there is no way. You can't tell by looking at a diamond where it came from. You can't tell by, you can't take the word of your local neighborhood jeweler that it didn't come from a certain conflict area simply because there's no way for him to tell either. And in fact, one of my research projects was to talk to retailers and to find out in as detailed a manner as I could what steps they take to ensure that no conflict diamonds enter their supply stream. And you know, they were very convincing in not wanting to have any conflict diamonds and to not be selling any. But when it came down to actual strategies that they could employ to determine, to make sure that they weren't, they were very lacking. There was nothing that they literally could do. And in fact, the best system that I heard of was one jeweler saying that he simply required affidavits from his suppliers in Tel Aviv and in Antwerp and in Bombay. In other words, a piece of paper that they're signing saying that none of their diamonds came that they know of came from a conflict zone. And again, there's no way for that supplier to necessarily know either, because diamonds are traded tens of times, perhaps hundreds of times, before they ever make it into a diamond polishing shop in Antwerp, Bombay, or Tel Aviv. And so there's no way to actually say for sure that a diamond has come from a clean source or from one of these war zones.
Would there be any protection in buying a colored diamond? Are they not mined in specific mines, or do some of the African mines have colored diamonds that come out of them too, or out of the same mine?
In Sierra Leone, I saw colors ranging from perfectly clear to a pale yellow to a bright orange to an almost turquoise blue. So that's probably a better indication than just blindly going in and hoping for the best. But as far as I know, the kimberlite is the substance that actually produces the diamond. It's a volcanic stew of different rocks and stones and geological debris that have blasted up from the middle of the earth, hundreds of years ago, centuries ago, and this kimberlite carries with it all different types of material, and in fact, it can snake horizontally under the surface of the earth for miles before finally erupting into the surface. So there's not necessarily any way to tell in that sense, as far as I know. I could be mistaken, but I've seen a wide variety of colors of diamonds that have been mined in this very small region of Sierra Leone.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. We're running short on time. The time is flying by. Before we go, though, I do want to ask you about this accord that 40 nations now have signed on to, reported in the New York Times earlier this month, November 6, 2002, 40 Nations in Accord on Conflict Diamonds, the headline. What are your thoughts about this UN-backed set of rules designed to stop illicit diamonds from being smuggled out of Africa?
Well, I think it's an excellent effort. What you're referring to is called colloquially the Kimberley process. And in the wake of the Global Witness Report of 1999 that I mentioned earlier, the diamond industry and diamond-producing countries had embarked on a roundtable discussion to try and come up with a solution for conflict diamonds, to figure out exactly how to keep them from being sold by the rebels and subsequently in the shopping malls around the world. And they ran into, the biggest problem that they ran into was literally how do you control a $6 billion a year industry that involves pebbles? Because diamonds can be carried anywhere on the human body or inside of it. They don't set off metal detectors. They're completely untraceable in terms of determining their origin by looking at it or even by any type of chemical analysis. So the question became exactly how do you do this? What are the controls that we can put on these very, very small pieces of wealth? Unlike, for instance, oil or timber, which are large enough that they can be tracked and monitored from as they move from place to place, diamonds simply cannot. You can a $1 million cache of diamonds can be visible in Sierra Leone, then it can vanish onto the bodies of several couriers who then scatter around the world and sell it from very different places, and you would never know that they were from Sierra Leone by looking. So the system that was adopted by these many countries is a certification process by which diamond importing countries would require that the exporting countries provide a certificate, an untraceable, unforgeable certificate. Basically, it's a paper trail for every stone that's being exported. And what it theoretically proposes to do is to answer the question of where every single stone came from. It attempts to provide through paperwork and bureaucracy what the stones themselves cannot provide chemically, which is basically a trail of exactly whose hands it's flowed through and exactly where it was discovered. The problem that I anticipate for this process is that simply due to the nature of the commodity, these very small diamonds that are very, very valuable, it will be almost impossible to create this complete uniform system that will work with 100% efficiency, simply because it's impossible to be present for a responsible person to be present for the discovery of every little pebble that eventually is going to be turned into an earring or a necklace. And in fact, when I was in Sierra Leone this last time, which was about a year ago, there is a system in place that is practically identical to the one being proposed by the Kimberley process. And I witnessed the discovery of a diamond at a diamond mine, a legitimate licensed one. And this was a mine in which all the day's diamonds were going to be physically accounted for and certified and then sent to be exported and then recertified at that stage. And then at that point, they would be safe to export as not being a conflict diamond. However, the diamond that I saw discovered simply went into the foreman's shirt pocket. There was nothing signed, mm-hmm. No witnesses to say, yes, this is a legitimate diamond. It weighs this much. Here are its properties. Here's a picture of it. Simply no way to tell. Mm-hmm. And there was no way to tell how many other diamonds the man might have had in his pocket at the time. And so my skepticism simply arises from not only the portability and the small size of the commodity that we're attempting to regulate, but the incredible value that that this commodity has, which would be an incredible temptation for anybody who would be interested in trying to mix their legitimate parcels with illegitimate parcels.
Yeah. We got to wrap it up here. We just have a very short amount of time left, Greg. But before we go, I want to ask you this question. How likely is it that consumers would say, well, it's time to put these away for now, like we did this with ivory?
Mm-hmm.
How likely is that to happen, and what kind of impact would that make? And maybe that's something that I would consider doing, but maybe there are some unforeseen consequences too. I don't know.
Well, in fact, there are. One of the industry's main defenses about conflict diamonds is that they constitute only 4 or 5% of all diamonds found in the world, that found or sold in the world, which sounds like a reassuringly small percentage. But at the same time, we're talking about a lot of death, destruction, and mayhem over the course of a decade. as a result of this very small percentage, which is a testament to their power and allure. However, the remaining 95% of diamonds that are discovered in the world provide millions of people with jobs and, in fact, are critical to the economies of nations, including some of the only peaceful countries in Africa. And Namibia and Botswana come immediately to mind. So a boycott on diamonds would be disastrous across the board. Mm-hmm. It would have a good effect on the diamonds that are being discovered and easily sold by rebel groups in Africa, but it would probably not be worth the good they would do compared to the harm that they would do to these other countries. And in fact, they could start wars in these other countries.
Mm. Well, that's where we have to leave it. Greg, thank you very much for talking with us this
afternoon.
Thank
you, Celeste.
Greg Campbell has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's an award-winning freelance journalist. His latest book is Blood Diamonds, Tracing the Deadly Path of the World's Most Precious Stones. The book is published by Westview Press.